Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW FM 91.7 in San Francisco. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. So you have some money to invest. The market appears to be oversold, and with interest rates at historic lows, the bond market's already priced so high you just don't see it as a great investment. Then it dawns upon you. With competitors shut down or operating on a reduced basis, maybe this is the time to start up a new business. As if we're entering the racetrack under a yellow flag. There's nowhere to go but up. Tonight, we're here to discuss starting up a new business. What are the biggest mistakes entrepreneurs make? There's much to discuss. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the local dialing area, call us toll free at 866-798-8255. Again, you want us to pay the freight, that's 866-798-8255. Bear in mind that our attorney guest cannot provide you precise legal advice without all the facts relating to a given transaction or a given case. However, we're more than happy to pass along the legal principles to assist you in your decision-making. And as always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic or any questions relating to starting a business, business litigation, or transactions. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. Once again, our phone number is 415-841-4134 or toll-free at 866-798-8255. We're fortunate tonight to have both a transactional attorney and a litigation attorney with us. So you'll get two different perspectives joining us tonight. A partner with Berliner Cohen in San Jose, Joshua Borger, practices commercial and civil litigation in a variety of areas, including unfair business practices, breach of contract, trademarks, trade secrets, fraud, employment, insurance coverage and litigation, Proposition 65, and general business litigation. A founding partner of Strategy Law, LLP, Tamara Powell uses her MBA and real estate broker's license and her very focused experience to meet the needs of business owners and real estate investors, providing for various business transactions, including negotiating contracts, limiting liability. And Tamara has extensive experience with formation and representation of corporations, LLCs, LLCs, general partnerships, and limited partnerships. And with that, Tamara, Joshua, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you for having us, Jeff.
You know, as I mentioned, we have both a transactional attorney and a litigation attorney with us tonight, hoping to get some really different perspectives. You've both been practicing law in Silicon Valley for a long time. In your experience, and this is each of you, what's the biggest mistake entrepreneurs typically make in starting a business?
I think the biggest mistake is that you just don't know what you don't know. And in business, what you don't know can hurt you. So not hiring experienced business advisors from the beginning to help, including a business attorney that's experienced with startups and a good CPA who can give you some proactive tax advice before it's too late and all they can do is put some numbers on a return for you. And also a good business insurance broker, not just your personal insurance broker that does your car insurance, but someone who really understands the business risks that you're potentially entering into.
It sounds self-explanatory. I mean, when I hear you say it, you don't want the person who insures your house, he may not know or she may not know that if you have a restaurant, you may have a choking hazard to deal with or something that's way outside the realm of some.
Yeah, that's true. A business broker for insurance can help you with things like a cyber insurance policy that your car insurance person may just not be aware of.
And similarly, the risks, if you do something along the way that turns out to be a mistake of your own, they may have some coverage for there that a business, that your home broker wouldn't necessarily know about.
That's true. E&O insurance, as well as directors and officers insurance, are both critical when you as an entrepreneur can be held responsible for things that go wrong in your business.
Josh, you soon, you're at a position where you pick up where a lot of stuff does go wrong. What are the kinds of things that you see?
Right. It's important to note that tomorrow is the one who's setting up the business. I am dealing with it once there's been a break of some sort. So I can say that the biggest mistake is when I'm reading partnership agreements or contracts that were not done professionally by a lawyer. Lawyers will think of things that if you didn't use a lawyer, you won't think of. For example, how do you value your business if one of the partners wants to leave? What do you do if you fail to provide goods to your customer because your vendor was late, and then your customer is potentially going to make a claim against you or sues you? Do you then have a claim against the vendor? Everything can end up in litigation. There's nothing we can do that prevents someone from filing a lawsuit, but it's going to be so much easier for your litigator to help you if you had someone like Tamara who drafted the agreements correctly. The second mistake that I see people make is that when they're upset, for example, with their partner and it's splitting apart, they try to resolve their problems themselves. And in that sense, they end up committing various wrongs, which we can get to later in the program, breaching duties. When they think they're doing something that's to their partner, they're actually stepping in it and hurting the partnership itself. And they can end up very liable for some of these missteps.
It seems to me that some of what Tamara was just saying about choosing a broker would be no less true in choosing a lawyer. You want somebody who does forward-thinking business transactions, and that might look ahead a little further than you have in figuring out where some of your problems might lie.
Absolutely. From my perspective, I'm always seeing the end game and seeing where things went wrong. So if things start to go wrong, I would much rather someone comes to me early. Otherwise, I'm spending a lot of time and a lot of money trying to unring a bell.
So that said, can't they always just hire an attorney later on once they have the business up and running and maybe capital is a little more free?
We actually see that a lot. And sometimes we can go ahead and fix it, but sometimes it's too late. Either way, it's usually a lot more expensive to fix it on the back end than it is to do it right up front. And there are some things that really are just too late and you've missed the bus on that. Choice of entity is a perfect example of that. If you choose the wrong type of entity for your business up front, that could mean anything from paying a lot more tax than you intended to. For example, an LLC is taxed very differently than an S corp or a C corp. Or it could mean that if you try to take advantage of losses up front by being a flow-through S corporation, you miss out on a rollover of qualified small business stock, which is a great opportunity later, which is only available if you started as a C corporation.
So, and obviously, not knowing what those things stand for makes it all the more important that you get a lawyer who does.
Exactly right. And an accountant. Usually, if you have a good accountant, they can nail down some of these things for you or send you to a good lawyer and vice versa. There are also securities laws that require you to make certain securities filings when you sell interests in your business to at least show that you're exempt from the securities requirements. And if you miss those deadlines are missed. And you could, as the manager of the LLC or an officer of the corporation, be held personally liable for your investors' money if something goes wrong. And the whole point of forming an entity to begin with is to protect you as the business owner, to protect your business, your personal assets from that business. And so we don't want to miss securities filings. We don't want to miss tax opportunities. And also, like Josh mentioned, it's so important to have good agreements up front if there's more than one founder. Because if you don't, all sorts of problems can come up in the future and you don't have any roadmap to solve them. And then you do land up in litigation. So although you can't prevent somebody from suing you, you can set a contract in place that really dictates the roadmap for how those disputes are taken care of. And ideally, you can avoid that litigation. At the same time, if you don't put agreements in place really early, that, and you know, that guy that was there in the first meeting sitting around your dining room table who really hasn't done anything since then might come back once the business is doing really well and say, no, I'm one of the founders. You know, I deserve an equal share here. And if you don't have good agreements in place from the beginning that show whether or not he deserved anything, you're going to have to deal with that. And then what I said earlier about piercing the corporate veil, the whole point of forming an entity is to protect you and your individual assets from things that go wrong in the business. And if you have messy corporate records, if you're commingling funds, if you're thinly capitalized, meaning you didn't put enough money into the business for it to really support itself, all of these are things that a good attorney up front should give you a roadmap on how to do right to avoid the risk that if you're not doing the corporation right and you're kind of ignoring it when you form your business or the LLC, the courts later on when somebody sues you can essentially ignore it as well. And it won't be there to protect you from liability when the time comes.
Josh, have you ever been that attorney that somebody hires too late in the game? They hire you once the business is up and running and the problems have already started, even if they don't know it yet.
That's typically when I get pulled in. I couldn't agree more with everything Tamara said. It's sometimes too late. Oftentimes it's not, but it will be harder for your lawyer to help you and it will be more expensive. Her examples were exactly correct. Let me give you a different one that I've seen. Trade secrets. One of the things you have to do is use reasonable measures to keep your secret a secret. If you didn't know that, or if you didn't know what those elements are that you're going to have to do to try to keep it a secret, then you may find by the time you get to court or you sue for your trade secret violation that you simply don't have a secret anymore. At that point, it would be too late. Other common examples where people have done something where you leave a business, but on your way out, you took business opportunities or you were starting to run your competing business before you actually left your employer. Again, if you had someone telling you initially that those are no-nos, you wouldn't have done it. And by that point, then, it's a little hard to unring that bell.
So we were talking about avoiding lawsuits. And we all have a sense that if somebody's suing us, it's probably because they're malicious. But in your experience, is that typically what happens when a new business gets sued? Is somebody being malicious and litigious?
No, it's not always that they're malicious. I think most of the time they're not. It's that there's a misunderstanding as to the law. It's also that they're emotional. They're doing what is in their best interest, even though if it doesn't verge into the realm of being malicious. They think what they're doing is right, but in doing so, they breach various laws. I'll give you an example. If the partnership, if you think that you would put more time, effort into your partnership, and therefore when you perceive it to be falling apart, you start taking money out of it because you think you're owed more money than your partner. You may be right that you put more time and effort, but the law won't see it that way because absent an agreement to the contrary, the partners are entitled to an equal share of the partnership profits. So when you took the money because you put in 90% of the effort, under the law, you actually stole from the partnership.
So couldn't you protect yourself with something like an LLC, a limited liability company?
Well, I'm going to defer to tomorrow on those issues, but some of these go back to if you're a member of a partnership, the partners can sue each other. So the fact that you have formed an LLC isn't going to prevent in a partnership, one partner from suing the other for taking a corporate opportunity or leaving and competing with the partnership unfairly, or taking partnership property, or just taking money from the partnership. I don't think the type of entity would matter.
No, but the entity itself doesn't matter. But what it goes back to is how you form the entity. So we see too many people who go online and just file their own articles of organization or articles of incorporation, and now they have an entity, but that doesn't give you any of those ground rules. It doesn't give you the shareholder agreement, or for an LLC, the operating agreement, which, if done right, should set forth the expectations of the parties. How much time are you expected to spend in this business? How much money do you have to put in up front? And what if we run out of money? Are you expected to put in more? Can we make you put in more? And what happens if you don't have it? All of these what ifs. And then as a transactional attorney, you know, my job is to prevent you from, you know, driving into the pothole. So I have to try to ask all of those questions up front. And a lot of them are really unpredictable, but we have to just kind of keep digging until we find them. Things like, what happens if you go through a divorce and can't afford to do this? What happens if, and you know, we see this relatively often, someone in your family has a drug problem and all of a sudden your assets are set aside for that drug problem or health problem or whatever the needs are, and the situation has now changed. And where we see this the most is what Josh mentioned, is that 50-50 ownership, where you've got two people that come together and say, you know, we've been great friends for many years, or we just met at Stanford or whatever their relationship is. And they don't think about what 50-50 means and how they're going to get out of a situation if they're deadlocked. So even just a simple operating agreement for an LLC that you're going to find online isn't going to deal with that issue. And that's where the good attorney comes in to plan for those things and offer some choices. So very often I say, please don't tell me everything you want in your agreement, because you're going to make it so difficult, it's hard for me to draft it. But if I can give you some ideas that might work or have worked for previous clients, I think it'll be really beneficial. And then I'll give them some choices. One of the really popular ones, if you're about situated somewhat equally economically, is kind of like what, you know, my mom did when I was a kid. There's one piece of cake, there's two of you, one of you cuts it in half and the other gets to pick which side you want. And we do that kind of thing in an LLC, which is, if something goes wrong and you're deadlocked, we shouldn't have to go to a judicial dissolution and shut this thing down where nobody gets the business. We should be able to say one of you picks the price and the other one says, am I willing to buy at that price, or do I want to sell at that price? And therefore, one of you gets the money and the other gets the business, and hopefully everyone can move forward in a way that makes sense. So there's a tremendous amount of opportunity to avoid issues if you can think through those things and draft them well up front.
And that's even dividing up what we both intend to stay with. But looking ahead where lives change, maybe my life partner gets a great job at another place and I'm going to walk away from the partnership. What do we do? Or walk away from an LLC. What happens to my shares? And these are things that I would imagine people don't normally think about, but is it easy to accommodate at the beginning and figure it out later on?
Jeff, can I add a common scenario that I've had to litigate?
Sure.
As Morris said, what you often have is friends coming in with an idea, and then the idea takes longer than one or both expected to generate money. So one of them wants out. One of them has a family and they have to actually put some money on in their pocket.
Put some food on the table.
Put some food on the table. And so then you have one of them that wants to value the business, the one who wants to stay astronomically high, because they said the value of this idea, if you had just stayed, was going to be worth a fortune. And the other one said, it's worth nothing or less because all we've done is incur debt. We have an idea, nothing more, and you weren't putting in a whole lot of time to it anyway. One of them, the one who's leaving, or One of them is one is going to have a very different valuation of it than the other.
The verge of making lots of money, and I'm the one leaving, I'm going to want to get bought out, I would think. And I would think that the other person's going to say, fine, here's $50. Go on your way, when it might be something much bigger.
Yes, and sometimes we can solve that not by changing the price, but by changing the terms of payment. Like, okay, I'll give you fair value for it, but I have 5 years to pay it off so that it doesn't bankrupt the company right now when I need access to that capital.
Or maybe convert capital into a royalty.
Yeah, usually we see something like a promissory note paid over time, but you can certainly negotiate all sorts of different agreements. It's just much easier to negotiate up front before you know which side of the deal you're going to land on.
And to those of our listeners, this is the kind of thing you won't learn by watching Shark Tank. You really do want to talk to a lawyer. Talk to one of our lawyers. You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Jeff Hayden. Tonight, we're talking about starting up a new business, avoiding the biggest mistakes entrepreneurs make. If you have questions for my guest, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic or any question relating to civil litigation, business formation, transactions, anything in that general genre. You're not limited to where we may be in our conversation. Call us at our expense at 866-798-8255. So let's move on a little bit. We've got the business started. We have some disputes forming between the principals. What's the likelihood we can just solve our own problems and move on without a lawyer?
It's unlikely. And this is what I was getting to before. People are emotional. They don't know the law. They will do what is in their best interest. And in doing so, they will likely violate the law. They'll violate the partnership agreement. They'll violate the corporation's code. Partners, for example, just some common examples, have what is known as fiduciary duties to each other, duties of loyalty to do what is in the best interest of the partnership. So if an opportunity comes for the partnership, you don't get to take the opportunity and form a competing company. Unfortunately, I've had to litigate that issue many times over. The one will say, well, the other person wasn't competent anyway, and the business was falling apart. That will be a disputed issue, and that's going to cost a lot of money to litigate. As I was mentioning before, partnership property belongs to the partnership. So a partner's personal interest is limited to the profits and losses. So when you're having a dispute with your partner and you start taking partnership property, you've actually made it worse for yourself. Then you're going to get sued. And again, as I was saying before, absent an agreement that tells you how you're dividing up profits, while you may think that you're entitled to more because you've done more, and you may well have done more, absent that in a contract, you're going to end up splitting the profits. Conversely, you'll end up splitting the losses. So this goes back to, if you want it done in a certain way, the law is going to have defaults. You may not like the defaults, but if you didn't have a lawyer set it up for you correctly, then you may be stuck with the defaults that you didn't like.
So we've been talking a little bit about disputes that might take place between partners or founders. Do you see similar issues with non-founders, people that weren't in on it from the start. Maybe it's employees or contractors or even investors who are promised stock?
Absolutely. I think one of the most important things any entrepreneur needs to do when you've got other stakeholders involved is stay on top of all of those relationships. Stay on top of your cap table, which is the capitalization for the corporation, or stay on top of the ownership of your LLC. It comes up even more in the corporate context because so many business owners, especially in Silicon Valley, are promising people stock for their participation in the company. And so you may hire a contractor and say, I'll give you X amount of this company. So, you know, first of all, plan for what that is. Plan for vesting. Make sure that you're not giving away any of your company unless and until they actually do the job they've been hired to do. So you want to plan for either a timeline of how much time they'll be working with you to earn that, or even better, if you can come up with clear milestones on what they have to accomplish before they get the stock. And then you don't want to promise ever in a corporation or a new business a percentage of the company, because every time you add a new employee with shares or an equity grant or a new investor, the shares that currently exist get diluted. And so if you promise someone 10% now, they keep that number in their head. And 10% of the company now, when you promised it to them, might only be 1% of the company years from now when it's worth a lot more. And so you never promise a percentage. You want to offer them a number of shares, because that way you promise 100 shares today, they still have their 100 shares tomorrow, regardless of what else has come in, and you have that right to dilute them. And then if you're planning correctly for the vesting, you also need to keep that tax advisor involved, because 83B elections can create a lot of problems if you don't do them, and there's a time limit there too. So that's back to getting good advice up front. You have 30 days to file an 83B election. When you get stock for services that has vesting concept over time, it's really important to get advice on whether or not to do that up front, and have your stakeholders go ahead and get their own tax advisors, help them with that if the company isn't.
And when you say 83B filings, can you tell us a little bit more about those?
Yeah, in general, by making an election under Section 83B of the tax code, the taxpayer is choosing to have the tax, the federal income tax treatment of your equity purchase be determined at the time that you get it, rather than at some later date when restrictions on that equity vests. So you choose to be taxed now instead of when it vests, because right now it's worth a lot less, assumingly, than it will be later when time has passed. And that way you're paying tax on a lower amount now and not paying tax again until you have a recognition event where you actually realize funds for selling that interest later.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco. I'm Jeff Hayden. We're talking about starting up a new business, the mistakes people make, the biggest mistakes that you don't want to make. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. If you're outside of San Francisco, call us toll free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call about anything on tonight's topic. You don't have to jump right where we are in the conversation. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
and I were talking about certain specifics, whether it's a founder or whether it's somebody else that comes into interest because you've offered them a percentage or a number of shares, whatever it is. But isn't that part of the general maxim? I mean, if you don't make someone's interest clear, they can say it was something else, rightly or wrongly.
They can, and they likely will. You'll end up having to litigate, were they an employee? Were they a founder? What were they promised? Too often, I end up in these disputes where everything was done orally. And then you're going back and taking a ton of depositions because you have to figure out what did the parties intend at that particular time, which was at that point years ago. And you're really trying to recreate a puzzle, which is difficult and expensive. And then you're really just, after that, leaving it up to the jury to decide whose version is of the dispute of facts is correct.
And even worse, if you're not going to a jury, we can avoid all of that. But what I've seen a lot is you go to sell your company. You're in the middle of a big M&A deal. I had one last year where the company was for sale for $10 million. And as the buyer went through the due diligence phase, we could not prove that employees that used to be on the cap table had signed off on all of their rights to the shares. And we couldn't find some of these employees anymore because this was a national company that had employees all over the country. And we were desperately trying to send out offers to get them to sign releases and to pay them something for it, but we couldn't even find them all. And in the end, the sale fell through and this business couldn't sell because they couldn't prove that they owned all of it.
That's a big hit. So even worse than the dispute, even worse than the litigation, it's the fact that somebody looking to buy in has to know that they'll be safe. And if you can't tell them that, you could lose a big fish.
Absolutely. Just from a little bit of messy paperwork or not doing, you know, not following up on all of the details. And they lost millions. It was very sad to see.
Jeff, lawyers love their war stories. So I have a case that has been going on for years. And one of the issues is, because nothing was done in writing, is creating who was a member of an entity, because people were coming in and out. And it wasn't clear at any time whether they were purchasing to become a member, whether the statements they were put in writing meant that they no longer were a member, wanted to be. And then it becomes what duties are owed to those people, and then what ownership interest did they have in the property that the partnership has. These cases will go on for years on end. And it could have been resolved had these issues ahead of time just been tidied up with a clear writing. How did people become members of this entity? How did you leave? How did you value their interest when you left? I have one that's been going on for, I believe, over 6 years. Could have been tidied up with a contract.
Yeah, I've seen similar ones. The worst being when someone has passed. So you now have a founder that is deceased and you have either multiple versions of an agreement, some that are signed, some that aren't. Other people hold partially signed ones and you have to figure out who has rights to this company. It can be very difficult.
And this doesn't even have to be a startup, or it doesn't have to be a restaurant, doesn't have to be high tech. It could be anytime people decide to go into a venture together. I personally saw some litigation that arose because two lawyers decided to take on a big case together. One of the lawyers was killed, and then partway through settling the case, everybody thought that they had this great settlement, and suddenly the estate of the deceased lawyer put in a claim for a substantial amount of legal fees, and everything was frozen, not just the legal fees, but everybody who thought they had settled. The whole thing was a mess. And it could have been simply resolved by putting it all in writing. What advice would you give to business owners who are new to being an employer?
well, there's a lot of pitfalls you can fall into when it comes to employment. That just can get ugly very quickly. One of the first things I tell new business owners to do is just sit down for an hour with an employment lawyer and just talk about, you know, the basics, things you need to know. I mean, you should definitely have proper employment contracts in place. You should be using a payroll company to make sure you're doing your payroll appropriately. But, you know, also there, again, it goes back to things you just don't know. Sometimes we have entrepreneurs coming from another country where the norms there are very different than they are here. For example, here in California, employment is at will. You don't need to promise anybody severance if you lay them off. And in some countries, that is the norm, is that you're required to give a certain amount of time of severance after you let somebody go. And so I had one entrepreneur that was putting that in all of his original agreements because he took what he had in another country and thought it would work here. In the US, even what you have in another state doesn't necessarily work in California. So I definitely advise you to talk to an employment lawyer or at least a very good HR counselor, get good agreements in place. Make sure you're not misclassifying employees as independent contractors, because that risk all comes back to you as the employer, and it can be very expensive.
You know, even if you thought you understood that, even if you went through something and had an agreement and everything ironed out with an attorney several years ago, so you'll try that again. We have had such a major sea change in that area in the last year after the passage of AB5 that what worked in California doesn't necessarily work in California.
Absolutely. And with that in mind, the next wave is discrimination lawsuits, because all of a sudden there's this heightened acknowledgement that discrimination exists and that we shouldn't just let it go. We need to do something about it. So you're going to see a lot more discrimination lawsuits, I think, in the coming future. But with that, they take an opportunity to go to a wage and hour plaintiff's lawyer who's going to find something you've done wrong. So the more you can get advice up front and follow the book, the better, because you will have less risk. And most of employment law doesn't necessarily coincide with common sense or, you know, just being a good person. I had one client who years ago started a new business. And one of his employees said, "Hey, I really need to work this weekend. I need some extra hours. I have a baby on the way." And the employer said, "I can't do it. I just can't afford the overtime." And the employee said, "No, that's okay. I don't want overtime. I just want regular pay. I need some more hours. Please just let me do it." And so he said, "You know what? Okay, I will." Employee never complained. They had a deal. But later on, someone else complained. And once the labor board, the EDD comes in and everybody starts reviewing your company, he ended up having to pay that employee money that he didn't even want for overtime, plus penalties and interest and everything else, because he did what he thought was being a good person. And that did not coincide with what the law requires. So you have to be very careful. The other thing today is social media policies. So you want a good handbook in place if you have employees. And your handbook today should have a social media policy in it, because if it isn't clear on what employees are and are not allowed to do on social media, your company can get a really bad reputation in the community, which can really hurt your value. So, you know, going back to the original stuff we were talking about with not being vague about your equity grants, you can't be vague about anything with employees. You need really clear rules and you need to follow them. And it's a great idea not just to talk to an employment lawyer up front so you know what to do, but to check in once a year and make sure you're doing it right and if anything needs to be updated. It's definitely a situation of penny wise and pound foolish if you don't.
So, you know, I started to ask another question, but I'm circling back to one of the things that you just mentioned when you talk about discrimination. It seems like discrimination has gotten a really negative rap in recent times. I remember a very well-established judge, a federal judge, in fact, who commented that discrimination is merely recognizing the differences. If you don't apply bias, then it's not necessarily such a bad thing in and of itself. Seems like times have changed and people are a lot more aware of discrimination. I don't see anything good coming out of it these days. I see smiles and shrugs, but...
Yeah, well, it could be good because as a society, at least we're acknowledging it. And I'd like to think that with additional training, like we have sexual harassment training and discrimination training for managers, that as a society, we will grow and improve and learn that differences among our employees add to the value of the company with added creativity and added ideas. And use that to our advantage, because when you're a business owner, having different perspectives is really helpful.
See, I think that what you just said is key. Seeing that there are differences may help diversify, but you can't treat people differently because of it. But recognizing it might help you create a broader base, get more ideas, more different perspectives, overall make better decisions that are more in keeping with the community.
I'm going to jump in from the litigator's perspective.
Sure.
It sounds like the line you're going down are perhaps good social ideas, but as far as the litigator, when you see the difference and act on the difference, the jury won't get past that.
Fair enough. Begs the next question. How do business owners protect themselves in contracts with vendors or suppliers, people other than perhaps equity owners or employees?
Yeah, since I draft contracts, I'll start with this one. I think drafting a contract with a vendor or a supplier or a client or customer is just as important as drafting them with your partners. I see too many startups that in an effort to bring in revenue and build up their business, land up giving away the store to a partner or a customer. And they think they can read an agreement, make sense of it, and you know it'll be good enough if they go it alone. But they can really use an attorney to craft the provisions they may not be thinking about in that agreement. Make sure they're not giving up any rights that are going to come back to haunt them in the future. I have seen a client become their customer's bank, where the customer is, you know, taking the product and not paying for it for months and months, and essentially using the business to finance their business. And so you need to have remedies built into those standard contracts that allow for things like collecting on your receivables. If they pay late, you should be able to get a late fee, get interest on the past due amounts, and you should think about other ways to go after and enforce your rights. And an important part of that is having an attorney's fees clause in your agreements, because if you can't collect the attorney's fees on some receivables that haven't been paid to your company, it may make it unrealistic to go after those receivables in the first place, because the attorney's fees could be way more than the amount that you would collect.
Well, let me ask you that. Let me throw that one to Josh, since you're seeing the stuff after the fact. Are there a lot of times you want an attorney's fees or don't clause in your contract?
If I have a client who I think is typically in the right, I'll want them to have one in it. If I have a client who I think is typically in the wrong, I won't want them to have it in it. The purpose of the attorney's fees, in the United States, unlike in England, you will not get to recover your attorney's fees, even if you're a prevailing party, absent certain exceptions. If it's in the statute that says you can, or it's in the contract where it says the prevailing party gets to recover their attorney's fees. You may have a very small matter. There may only be $20,000 in dispute. And if you don't have an attorney's fees clause, you will not want to litigate it because you will absolutely spend more on your attorney than you would ever recover. But you will see people litigating $20,000 disputes when there's an attorney's fees provision, because they think the recovery will be much more. Other things to try to incentivize your vendors, suppliers, to do what they're supposed to do. The common scenario that I see is that a customer doesn't get the product that they ordered, and that's because the vendor supplier didn't give it to the person they contracted with, so they couldn't make the good. And so the person who was making the actual product, who didn't have everything they needed, is the one who gets sued. That person should have an indemnity provision in their contract with the vendor or supplier. And what that's going to say is if they get sued by their customer and it's the fault of the vendor or supplier, then they're going to turn around and the vendor or supplier is going to have to pay for all the money they had to pay this customer in the lawsuit, as well as their attorney's fees and their costs. That will give the vendor and the supplier the incentive to resolve the issue quickly and hopefully where it doesn't even get that far then.
So we've spoken a little bit about the people you enter into business with, the employees, now maybe vendors and suppliers. What steps should you take to protect your intellectual property?
I'll jump in as far as just starting a new company. One of the things you want to do from the very beginning is choose your business name very carefully. You don't want to be stepping on anyone else's rights. Just because a name happens to be available with the Secretary of State and you can file articles giving you that name does not mean that you won't get a cease and desist letter from some other established company that's already using something similar that could be confusing in the marketplace. And you really don't want to put a lot of money into your domain name and your branding and be forced to change the name of your company down the road. So you want to start with a trademark search, not just the business name, but any product name that you're going to be advertising or branding. And do a basic internet search, you know, dig hard and see if anyone else is using something else that could be considered confusing in the marketplace. And again, just because it's available or the Secretary of State will give it to you, it doesn't mean it's a good idea to use it. They will actually let you use company names that were previously used but are no longer active. And I've had to deal with a few clients over the years that got sued based on some other previous company that had that name, and they're using it now. And it was an expensive process just to prove that they weren't suing the right people and to get my client out of that context. At the same time, if you have intellectual property, don't discuss it with third parties. Don't talk about it around the dinner table with friends unless you have an NDA in place, because that is your value. And you know, friends today may not be friends tomorrow or may not be supporting you, and you never know where that information can go. So you really want a good NDA in place. Don't assume that some NDA somebody hands you is okay or something you get off the internet. NDAs can have some pretty sneaky provisions in them. Either the confidentiality will only last until the end of the year or until I choose to do something different with it. Or there can be something that when you're dealing with large companies, we call a residual clause where, yeah, they'll give you back everything you showed them. But, you know, to the extent some of that information remains in their brain, and that helps them develop new products that are, you know, slightly different, they can use it. And that's not okay. You want to make sure you limit that. Otherwise, you can't give away that secret sauce until you have an agreement that will protect it. It's also a good idea if this is something that might be patentable to talk to a patent attorney early and find out if you can get a patent on it. And then make sure that you keep that information only in the U.S. and that it's not disclosed to anyone from outside of the U.S., which could happen easily. You could be at a conference talking about your product and someone from Japan comes over and takes a look at what you're doing. That may result in your product now not being patentable in Japan because it's been disclosed there. So you have to really think up front about whether your concept has international opportunities and protect those, because that those opportunities to protect your intellectual property could be lost otherwise.
And when you're talking about intellectual property, it can be a super secret computer circuit or something as simple as an idea for a children's story. I mean, it's just really your thoughts, your ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. And someone else can take it and run with it, and then you can't prove that they didn't think of it separately, unless you have that NDA that says you were disclosing it to them on this date and they agree to keep it confidential and not to use it.
And who knows, in their mind, they may have been the one that brought it up to you here. So you've got these intellectual property items, whether it's trade secrets or the like. What kind of measures can you take to protect them?
Right, and this is where I was saying the first thing you have to prove for trade secret misappropriation is that you in fact had a trade secret. And in order to prove you had a secret, you have to prove that you used reasonable measures to maintain its secrecy. A non-disclosure agreement is certainly what we hear about, but there's many other avenues that a jury is going to be instructed upon and have to weigh to determine whether you had a trade secret. An NDA may not be sufficient. You'll want to mark documents in your office as confidential. You'll want to instruct employees to treat it confidential. If you don't have to give every employee access to it, don't. Only give the employees access to the trade secret who had a reason to know it, who needed to know it to do their jobs. The more steps you take to maintain its secrecy, the easier it's going to be for you to argue that you in fact had a secret.
It's like if I tell you something that I don't want you to repeat, I'd best tell you rather than trust your judgment to know that it's something I don't want you to repeat.
It's a reasonable measure. A few years ago, someone who worked for Coca-Cola is perhaps the best example of a trade secret. A few years ago, someone who was working there, whether she had the actual recipe or not, tried to sell it to Pepsi. She was fired. I think she went to jail. Pepsi blew the whistle. The fact that she may have, I don't know if she in fact told Pepsi or not, probably not, but even if she did, if Coca-Cola took reasonable steps, the fact that it got leaked by someone who was violating the law and their agreements didn't make it any less of a trade secret. So you have to use all the reasonable measures you can under the circumstances.
So we have a bit of material left. We have about 5 minutes left or so. It's unfortunate. I don't think we're going to get to it. I think I'd like to give you each a couple minutes, maybe two and a half minutes each, for any closing thoughts, anything you want to say in summary. There were some things I was hoping to get to, such as now your business is up and running and other people are starting to take advantage. You know, what constitutes fair and unfair competition, but we didn't get there. If you want to work that into your last few minutes, have at it, but you've got about 2 minutes. Who would like to go first? Tamara, you're up.
Okay.
Thoughts? Anything you want to say in summary?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say that if there's a single most important piece of advice I have for new business owners, it would be don't give away a piece of your company unless you have to. All of these issues with partners and other owners and investors come up when you bring others in. So if you're going to do that, be very careful about how you do it. And with employees, just because you're in Silicon Valley, it doesn't mean you have to give them stock options. Talk to an attorney about alternatives like bonuses based on performance or phantom stock so that you can retain control of your company as much as possible as you build it. And the more you can bootstrap on your own, the more of your company you get to retain and the more control you keep. Life will actually be easier. Of course, you know, don't let that stop you from growing your company, but just grow it carefully. And don't just see the attorney once and get a form. If something changes, make sure you have somebody that you can call with a question. And with, you know, if somebody makes a change to an agreement, you can just ask if that's something that you need to revisit.
And that would be true, I would think, both on your structure, but also the way you deal with your employees, through the employment attorney, your vendors, whatever it may be. You probably want someone on call.
Yeah, absolutely. And with the current economic environment, there's going to be so much change. Some of the things we've mentioned here, but with layoffs and business shutdowns and PPP loans and all sorts of other things coming up, I think that there's an opportunity to do things really well, and there's an opportunity to get into a lot of trouble coming up. So, you know, stop and think before you sign anything.
Josh, you want to take a couple minutes for any closing thoughts?
Sure. I will take you up on the opportunity to speak about advertising. We all know these days that competition is very fierce, and there's a tendency to make exaggerated statements about your product or a competitor's product. In California, we have what is called fair competition, and then we have that line where you went into of unfair competition. And generally, opinions are going to be okay, but if you make false statements or a statement that you simply had no reasonable basis for making that turned out to be false about your product or a competitor's product, then you're liable to get sued. The line where you go from an opinion to a false statement is going to be something that the jury will have to tangle with. It is not a clear line. But when I say that, you can debate, did you go from an opinion to a false statement? You will have spent a lot of money on lawyers by the time you got there.
Thank you.
My advice would be clear advertising.
And that'll be our last word tonight. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Tonight we presented a show on what entrepreneurs get wrong and how to avoid those mistakes. Our guests tonight have been Joshua Borger from the firm of Berliner Cohen in San Jose, and Tamara Powell, a founding partner of Strategy Law LLP, also in San Jose. Thank you both for joining us tonight. Your Legal Rights will be back next week, again at our new time of 6 o'clock. So for Joshua Borger, Tamara Powell, and at the controls, Debbie Kennedy, I'm Jeff Hayden. Thank you to all of you for listening. Be safe and have a good night.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. Uh-huh.